And it's time for our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. We have noticed that when you run a media segment, a monthly media segment in this time in history, the topics come fast and furious. We try to lock up the topics a few days in advance, but the avalanche of news frequently buries us right up to the last minute. And that's okay. There's always plenty to talk about. We do define media very broadly. We take in items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from virtual reality to books. We join once again our regular guests, Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi, from the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. Welcome, Precious.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Good to have you. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks, Pat.
And just as we were talking about the fact that things change up at the last minute, driving to work this morning, I hear the news that Julian Assange of WikiLeaks fame has been arrested in London. Essentially, the Ecuadorian embassy told Scotland Yard, we don't want him here anymore, come get him. Scotland Yard did. He is now in custody, and there is talk of extradition to the United States to face the charges for the secrets that he had unveiled from the American government. And not even sure, I don't think the Clinton campaign charges involved in here, but it gets to a media discussion because, you know, is Julian Assange a journalist in some sense, or is there some other better definition for him?
I relate him to maybe one of the first main people of hacktivism, in which using hacking techniques and different type of online and technology approaches to create different types of movements or to sometimes have some types of violations of people's information and putting it out there and information that he wants people to have. So I feel that he's really related to that type of hacktivism, anonymous, WikiLeaks type of movement. Maybe one of the first people who is famous. There's been a lot of people prior to him who have participated in that type of work, labor, online digital labor. But he's, because of his look and his presence and his following, he is one of probably the more well-known people.
I mean, certainly, he's always acted the part of the supervillain. You know, there's a great
expect him to stroke the cat.
Right. Well, there's a great old SNL sketch in which he does exactly that. You know, stroking the cat and. You know, I think what you feel about Julian Assange really comes down to, what you believe about how involved he is in the collection of a lot of this information, right? I mean, if he's just a publisher, you know, great, he's a publisher, and that's often what he claims, right? There's a lot of allegations out there about the fact that, no, he's actually more intricately involved in the invading of privacy and collecting information.
So that becomes the question, information or influence? What is the larger point of what he does here?
Right. Well, I think, as a journalist, right, if I'm a journalist, if I come across misbegotten info that's brought to me, but it's for the public interest, then maybe I have a reason to publish that. But do I cross an ethical line if I'm then saying, like, trying to convince people to hack into other people's private information, or actively involved and paying people to do it, or who knows what else? Then obviously we're crossing some ethical lines in what we consider journalism.
Yeah, I would hope that journalists don't follow the practices of Julian Assange. I think that he definitely has his motivations and his very strong points of view. Journalists are more supposed to report information, try to not have too much bias, but he definitely has a very strong type of bias, motivation, certain goals.
But it's interesting, too, because there is a tension between Julian Assange and journalistic organizations. I know the New York Times in particular has come under fire from him for wanting to do what journalists do, which is to go figure out what's the relevant stuff here, where he's all about just dumping the dumpster upside down.
Yeah.
But we've seen, that can be really irresponsible, right? I mean, when we just dump information out, what are the unintended consequences there? I do think journalists have a responsibility and editors have a responsibility to consider what impact might we have that we're not intending, might we actually be harming the innocent in some way? And I think that's possible with these kinds of information dumps that aren't sometimes sort of looked at very carefully.
We will see what becomes of Julian Assange in the days ahead. He's already been convicted of not showing up for his previous court appearance, and now there's the UK wouldn't extradite to the United United States if there was any chance of a death penalty charge, but that does not appear to be in play here. So we'll see how things come out with this. Let's move on and talk about this interesting Trump campaign video, which I would have played little clips of, but Warner Brothers probably would have sued us too. So Donald Trump puts out this Donald Trump campaign puts out this video let me get the text in here.
Right.
It goes along with the figures, including of people that Donald Trump and his people hate, including Rosie O'Donnell, Bryan Cranston, Amy Schumer showed up in the one GIF that I was able to see. Mm-hmm. But apparently the text card said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they call you a racist. Donald J. Trump, your vote, prove them all wrong. This is all with periods. Trump, the great victory, 2020, using a Dark Knight font. And what do you know, music from the
Dark Knight
movies.
Rises. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, it was a pretty, I mean, it is kind of an interesting campaign video in and of itself, right? That, you know, the tone, I don't know that we've had a president run for reelection on the strength of being called a racist. Like that's not, I don't think something we've had recently.
Yes, I would not agree there.
But yeah, it was all this, you know, this very ominous Dark Knight Rises score, and it's like, you know, the flashes of the image, and it wasn't very well edited, honestly.
No.
But even before it got taken down, there were a lot of jokes on sort of film Twitter, like what was it, as edited on iMovie, like someone obviously didn't know, you know, it wasn't a very savvy media editor. But yeah, you know, they used the Warner Brothers copyright without permission, and they immediately took it down. What was interesting, though, is that the tweet was I don't know if it still is up, but it was up for a little while and had, you know, media is taken down for copyright infringement. They didn't delete the tweet. They just, the video was taken.
The empty hole stayed there with
yeah.
the tweet around
so
it.
So it's kind of this kind of perfect symbol there that was interesting.
Yeah, I just find it really interesting, too, how the campaign embraces racism. And I think that the continuous creation of having people divided in itself, it's not helping anybody. It's not helping people who feel that they're the majority or in power. It's just making things more complicated. And I think it makes me look at different countries that are more inclusive and try to support all of their people, and just hope that we could one day move in that direction after this whole presidency.
Since this is a media segment, I do take particular interest in the fact that the power of the media organizations is such that when the House of Representatives says to the Treasury Department, send us Trump's tax returns, the chief of staff at the White House says, not going to happen in a million years. When Warner Brothers says, stop using our music, it happens
right.
in seconds.
Well, right, because, I mean, you know, yeah. Warner Brothers has a pretty clear copyright claim there, and you know, it's really non-negotiable, and there's going to be a lawsuit if they don't do it, and... yeah, so I think it's the legal ramifications in a corporate dispute essentially versus the ramifications that are political when there's disputes in D.C. are interesting.
Signals and Noise is our monthly media segment here on the Jefferson Exchange. Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi join us from the Communications Faculty at Southern Oregon University. You can join us as well by phone, 800-838-3760, and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I can see Darnell saying it along with me, but it's because during the fun drive, we gave out the other phone number a lot, so we have to get back to the old mode. Let's talk about Lil Nas X and Billy Ray Cyrus doing a song called Old Town Road. Before we say anything about it, let's just listen.
Oh, awesome. Gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. Hat down, cross town, living like a rock star. Spend a lot of money on my brand new guitar.
All right, so that's just a touch of it. As you can see, it has, I mean, there are banjos in it. There are people doing line dances in the video. And it's certainly got a hip-hop kind of beat. It debuted on the Hot 100 for Billboard, the Hot R&B hip-hop songs, and the Hot Country songs. And then Billboard took it off the country chart.
Right, and when I saw this, I was so excited to talk about something other than politics. And I was like, oh, great, a music story. You know, this was really fascinating to me because you know, I'm a Ray Charles fan, so I've sort of followed Ray Charles' career, and you know, he had Modern Sounds and Country came out and in his career, and had this similar debate about, oh, you know, the country music establishment rejected this album as being, this isn't really country, and it's and a lot of that has to do with this idea that country music is seen as white music, and so this created this decision by Billboard to remove this song from the country chart pretty immediately, created a lot of blowback and debate about, oh, wait a minute, is it because it has a hip hop beat behind it, or is it because it's a black artist? And you know, Little Nas X did this project independently. You know, he wasn't signed to a label yet when he recorded this, so the success is kind of phenomenal for him. And the controversy has probably helped him. And he reached out to Billy Ray Cyrus, and Billy Ray Cyrus re-recorded the song with him to add his voice as kind of a dare to Billboard, say, is it still not country? So I think it's a really interesting discussion about, you know, how do we define musical genres? I mean, country music, so much of the source of country music actually comes from African-American musical traditions, you know, the traditions of, you know, slaves in the South and those kinds of things. And so there's a lot of black influence in country music, and yet country music tends to be pretty white.
Yeah, very white.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel that this mix of genres is not the first time it happens. There's a duo, Outkast, and their later albums, like in early 2000 and mid 2000, has a lot of reference to Southern sounds and country music, but it would always go into the hip hop genre. And hip hop is interesting because it also has had embrace certain white rappers such as Macklemore, Eminem, Iggy Azalea, who they try and emulate a style of black rappers. So I could see that there's some type of protectiveness regarding race and sound within certain type of genres. And it seems like some genres are easier to cross over to, maybe sometimes Christian to pop or country to pop, but it is a bit harder to cross back over into country.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the debates have been that, you know, there have been increasing number of white country artists who have been starting to borrow hip-hop beats into their music and things like that. And, of course, Billboard, their statement was pretty obscure. It kind of said, well, there just aren't enough country elements.
It does not embrace enough elements of today's country music to chart in its current version.
Right, and so where is that standard, right? And that doesn't exist, so it's a, I thought that was a fascinating debate, and I haven't seen whether or not the version with Billy Ray Cyrus has gone back on the country charts or not. I'm not sure, but I know that it did hit. I think it went to number one on one of the charts.
Yeah, we'll have to figure out which one, and just I'll look it up while we're talking here. But yeah, it gets to the whole discussion again of genre. What is the genre? And of course, you know, I'm looking over Precious's shoulder at the music building at Southern Oregon University, where hear people talk all the time about music is music. Quit trying to categorize it, you know. But of course, when you're in the commercial music business, as Billboard is part of the whole scene there, you're looking for genres. I'm reminded too when we talk about things like you know, black artists, white artists, that the R&B chart was called the race record chart at one time.
Right, exactly, and that's why, you know, a lot of this goes back to the very, you know, beginnings of these chart descriptions and deciding, oh, well, over here is the white music and over here is the black music, and those things don't cross over.
Let's move on to a different topic here. It's about media and media lawsuits, and this is where we bring in Representative Devin Nunes of the California 22nd Congressional District, who has made a lot less news since his party went into the minority at the beginning of the year. But he has filed, it's getting a little complicated, he's already filed lawsuits against Twitter for the Devin Nunes' cow and Devin Nunes' mom, which is now Devin Nunes' alt-mom, Twitter accounts. And then he also filed a defamation lawsuit for $150 million this week against the McClatchy newspaper chain for an article in the Fresno Bee about a winery, a company that Nunes partly owns, that had a San Francisco Bay cruise in 2015 attended by some of the winery's top investors, and somebody said that the cruise included drugs and prostitution. It didn't say Devin Nunes was on the cruise, but still, you know, there's a bunch of stuff to unpack here in terms of what people get to say about other people out in the wide world, especially when the people they're talking about are public figures.
Right. And I think there's also there's two issues here. There's the legal grounds of the lawsuits, which we could talk about. I'm not a legal expert in this matter. But then there's just smart communications policies, right? And you know, I have to say, Devin Nunes and these lawsuits kind of won the crown of the of king of the cell phone, because as soon as these lawsuits went public, it was the trending topic on Twitter, and everyone was laughing hysterically because the complaints are full of these tweets that are pretty hilarious, dunking on Devin
so he
Nunes.
Brought more attention,
right?
Than if he just
brought
left
them way more attention to the issue, and probably, you know, a lot more followers to those accounts. You know, and there's some things in the lawsuits that are just very not media savvy. So, for instance, the one against, I think, the McClatchy lawsuit, at one point they allege that a Twitter user had bolded some certain key terms, where it was obviously clear that the lawyer or a legal aide or someone had searched for those terms. And when Twitter searches come up and you search for terms, those terms show up as bolded in the tweet. It's not that someone bolded those. It's that those were the terms you were looking for. So it just kind of shows, like, oh, the incompetence here is kind of funny.
Taking umbrage to things that somebody with a certain amount of media savvy would not have taken umbrage
exactly.
to.
And also, I think he needs to realize that he's not the first person to have all types of tweets and accounts created around him on Twitter. It's just that the landscape, the digital landscape of how Twitter is. So I don't feel that the lawsuit in terms of Twitter is very effective.
Yeah, I would be surprised if it goes very far. But yeah, I don't know that you can really sue for Twitter being mean to you.
No.
Well, and it's interesting because one of the things, just doing a little research, I have to research these things, of course. So I went to Devin Nunes's cow and Devin Nunes's alt mom, and the pinned tweet at Devin Nunes's alt mom is a retweeting of Aaron Blake on Twitter saying, "Well, isn't this embarrassing? Last Congress, Devin Nunes co-sponsored a bill called the Discouraging Frivolous Lawsuits Act."
Well, you know, the other thing, especially the Devin Nunes' mom, was really fun to read in the complaint because it kept saying, "Devin Nunes' mom said this," and "Devin Nunes said that." And of course, it just reads like it's literally Devin Nunes' mom saying these things. Whereas when you see it on Twitter, it obviously isn't real. But when you read it in the complaint, it actually sounds more, again, like it's his mom saying
it. In fairness to Devin Nunes and Congress, the Discouraging Frivolous Lawsuits Act was specifically about lawsuits against water agencies. So I did that much research to figure out that that's what House Bill 1179 was about. We have about 5 minutes left, so there's certainly time for pick threes for the two of you. But I also want to broach the subject, which we may come back to in a separate segment, about the digital cinema major that you're Southern Oregon University.
Yeah, today, as you all probably know, I'm sort of the film guy at SOU, and we are awaiting today. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission in Oregon is on the consent agenda to approve our new digital cinema major that we've been working on for several years. And so we're going to be doing a big rollout of that later today, but with lots of social media, you know, press releases, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, the big media splash from one of our media experts here on The Exchange. This is our Signals and Noise segment with Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi. Let's do the pick threes, your three favorite things in media of all types for the current moment. We'll start with you, Precious.
Yeah, I've had three that are very different. In the New York Times, there was an article written by Mustafa Akyol, and he introduces his article with the topic of Brunei and the stoning of gay and lesbian people, mm-hmm. or gay people and the flogging of lesbian people, but moves it deeper into the ways in which he, as himself as a Muslim, feels that using such things as religion to justify these types of acts of violence and human rights violations is not understanding contemporary Islam. So his article really goes deeper into the discussion of more than just this is wrong and we shouldn't act violently, but and it not just it being Brunei, but the understanding of all different cultures and countries and how we need to understand that humans rights violations are never acceptable. And stoning, the amputation of limbs, that really needs to be rethought. So
right. You can't contextualize those.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I thought that's a really great way to continue this dialogue. And then also the book, The Greenhouse by Erla Ava Olafster, who focuses on just kind of everyday life in Iceland. And then the documentary Three Identical Strangers, directed by Tim Wardell, on three triplets who were sent off to different families, adopted by three different families.
All right. By the way, before we get to Andrew's, I just checked Old Town Road by Lil Nas X is number one on the Billboard chart.
All right.
The Billboard chart. Leaps there, it says, just 2 days ago.
Well, again, as we all know, the Ashland Independent Film Festival starts today, and so this is the time of year where for 5 days I disappear into theaters and don't come out until it's over.
Blinking heavily.
So that's my number one pick. Obviously, I'm excited about that. Lots of things to see there. My second is things I'm anticipating. Obviously, big finales. There's, of course, like everyone else, I'm excited about the return of Game of Thrones and Infinity, the closing of Avengers Endgame, and seeing what happens to Thanos. And then my last one is the Lost album of Marvin Gaye that came out, was it last week or the week before? You're the Man? You're the Man, which came out. A lot of the songs on the album were already previously released in other forms, but this is, I think, the follow-up to Let's Get It On, and was, you know, going to be a, you know, everyone anticipated to be a smash hit, but it had some political messaging in there, and
the record company
sort of was
reluctant.
Burying it a little bit, and he pulled it. He was so disappointed by how this first single release went that he pulled the album, so it's been lost, and it's been released, and it's great.
I want to bring up, because each of you triggered a memory in me of a connection to something else. You mentioned the finales. We have really taken to the Amazon Prime series Catastrophe, about an American man and an Irish woman who meet in London, get pregnant,
too.
And decide, well, okay, I guess we'll stay together. So it goes through several seasons of some serious ups and downs, and it ends. That's all I can say. Spoiled the movie. And then also when you, Precious, were mentioning the New York Times series about Brunei, the New York Times work on Brunei, reminded me that I sat down last Sunday and read the three-part lengthy New York Times magazine piece about the Murdoch family and the amount of money and power they have pulled together over the years, and how the empire has begun to shift into a new mode with the sale of the properties to Disney. But you get the sense that some corporations are stronger than countries. And you can look at that to figure out which corporations and countries. But it was an all-afternoon read and worth the time. So thank you both for joining us once again for our Signals and Noise segment. Andrew Gaye and Precious Yamaguchi from the Communications Faculty at Southern Oregon University.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.